Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies, part of the New Books Network. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Elizabeth Baer about her excellent new book, The Genocidal Gaze, From German Southwest Africa to the Third Reich. Elizabeth, hello and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm really looking forward to talking with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. Well, Elizabeth, we like to begin our interviews by asking a little bit about your background, where you went to school, how you became interested in your subject, your dissertation advisor.
Sure. So I currently serve as a research professor in English and African Studies at Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter, Minnesota, though I'm now living in the D.C. area. I did my undergraduate education at Manhattanville College, which when I attended was a Catholic women's college and is now co-ed and non-denominational. I did my master's degree at New York University in Greenwich Village, and my PhD work at Indiana University. Susan Gubar was my director. Her name may be familiar to some listeners as the author of The Mad Woman in the Attic, a very famous book in feminist literary criticism. I grew up in the 1950s and 1960s and was very influenced by the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement, the women's movement. And so if there's one thread that runs through my scholarship, I would say it's a focus on social justice issues. Late 1990, I made a trip to Germany with my family. My daughter was studying German at the time in the country, and we visited castles and beer halls, but we also went to Mauthausen and Dachau. And I came out of those camps asking how could the Holocaust have happened? How could this happen in the mid-20th century? There was very little Holocaust education when I was in elementary and high school in the 1950s and 60s. I was raised as a Catholic, so I didn't come to a study of the Holocaust through Judaism, which is the case for many scholars in the field. And in the early 1990s, I had the opportunity to do a three-week Holocaust studies program with the Jewish Labor Committee in Poland and Israel. And after that, I began to teach the Holocaust at the college level and eventually to do scholarship on the topic. In a very kind of serendipitous way, my daughter was a graduate student in German, and she translated some family letters for my mother in which she found a reference to Aunt Nanda, who has written a book about her experiences in Ravensbrück concentration camp. And she called me and told me about this, and I looked up the book. In German, it was called Der gesegnete Abgrund. It came out in 1946, so it was a very, very early camp memoir. And she was a Catholic who had been arrested for her work in the Catholic resistance movement. And so my daughter translated the book, and we published it together in English. It's called The Blessed Abyss. And that was the beginning of my research and publication on the topic of the Holocaust. And while I was working on a book about the golem in Holocaust literature, I saw a reference to a genocide by the Germans that had occurred in Africa, and I knew nothing about this. I heard a paper at the German Studies Association conference that referenced this genocide, and I also talked with someone at the Holocaust Museum while I was attending a seminar there, the museum in D.C., and just got intrigued that there seemed to be some parallels between this early genocide and what the Nazis did during the Holocaust. So I made 3 research trips to Africa, and I also did some research in the colonial archives in Frankfurt. And initially I thought the book would be maybe an article length, but then I gathered more and more material, and one of my colleagues at Gustavus said, no, you're gonna write another book. You have enough material. And so I began chapter by chapter. I presented my work at the African Studies Association conference annually for 5 years, and the book came out in late 2017.
So was the book originally going to be a series of articles, or just...
Well, originally it was going to be one article.
Originally it was going to be one article.
Yeah, but then I just found more and more material that was related, and actually I ended up eliminating some chapters that I had originally thought I would include. There are a lot of historians who have written about this early genocide, some German and some English writing historians, but no one had written a book about literary representations of this German genocide in 1904 in their colony in Africa. And since my training is in literature, not history, although there's a great deal of history involved in this book, obviously, that was the path that I decided to take for the book.
Yeah, and I think now would be a good time to talk about some of the literary concepts in your book, because you do draw on a number of them that might be less familiar to our listeners. Sort of concepts like the gaze, and then the imperial gaze and the genocidal gaze. Could you explain those to us, and sort of why you chose to use them to frame your book?
Okay. So the concept of the gaze is a trope in literary criticism, and the term was originally created by a scholar named Laura Mulvey to talk about the way that male members of an audience of cinema objectify women that they see on the screen. So the male gaze looks at the screen, and it objectifies the women who are acting in the film. The imperial gaze was a term created by E. Ann Kaplan, and it's part of post-colonial theory. And essentially the idea is that the imperial or colonial member of a society looks down on the colonized. They assign the colonized an inferior status. So it's a gaze of disdain, you might say. So I was familiar with both of these terms, and I was reading one morning when I was doing research on the book. I originally entitled the book Germans Looking at Africans, Africans Looking at Germans. So I had this notion of looking in my mind, but I hadn't really come up with what was going to bring the book together, what was going to be the through line in the book. And I was reading a book on the female gaze, and I suddenly thought to myself, I'm writing a book, but it's not about the female gaze. It's about a genocidal gaze. So I went right to my computer and Googled genocidal gaze and saw that no one had used the term. And that was one of those aha moments that sometimes happens when one is writing. And so then that became the title of the book, The Genocidal Gaze, and it became the way that I organized all of these different literary texts that I was working on. So to define what I mean by that, think about the imperial gaze, this gaze of assigning an inferior status to the colonized. When that gaze turns deadly, when the colonizer gazes upon the colonized as subhuman or as expendable, as inconvenient, then the imperial gaze morphs into the genocidal gaze. It becomes a justification for genocide, for the extermination of these inferior, indigenous, colonized people. And that's exactly what happened in Germany's colony in Africa, a country we now call Namibia, located right above South Africa on the west coast of the continent. And so you could say that the genocidal gaze is a trope of perspective. And so it's my term, an original intervention in the discourse of the gaze to explain links between this genocide in Namibia, then it was called German Southwest Africa, and the genocide of the Nazi Holocaust. And I was so pleased when the University of Namibia Press decided to bring out an African edition of the book, because it meant that people in Namibia could learn more about this devastating genocide. Just to give the audience some idea of numbers, the death toll in this genocide was 50% of one indigenous group of the Nama. So that was 10,000 people killed, and 80% of another indigenous group, the Herero, and that was 70,000 people killed. So the best number we can come up with, and, you know, we'll never have an accurate number, but is about 80,000 people who died in this genocide in various ways, in battles, in early versions of concentration camps, in a death camp that the Germans created on an island called Shark Island, starvation, rape, sexual violence was very prevalent. Forced labor, which eventually killed people, and medical experimentation. And a lot of these terms are going to sound familiar to an audience who knows something about the Nazi Holocaust. And so, yes, I am drawing links between the two. Another term I use frequently in the book is the continuity thesis. And simply stated, this means that there are significant connections between why and how the Germans killed so many indigenous people in their colony, and how and why they killed 6 million Jews and 5 million other victims in the Holocaust. And I might describe the why as ideology. Key term in the book is racial hierarchy. And the Germans definitely looked on themselves as superior. The racial hierarchy they established privileged the Germans, and it dehumanized the Africans. They were seen as barbaric, as not having any kind of history or religious beliefs, having failed to utilize the land effectively. They were mostly cattle herders. And they were seen as bestial. These terms, I'm sure, will be familiar to people who have read African literature and know about stereotypes held of Africans. And so the Germans came to believe that these people could be eliminated so that the Germans could possess the land. And we tend to associate the term Lebensraum or living space with the Holocaust, but actually this is a term created by a German man named Ratzel during the era of colonization in 1897. The Germans had colonized Namibia starting in 1885, and they remained in control of the colony until the early years of World War I. So this is what I call the genocidal gaze, this idea that they could eliminate indigenous people so that they could take control of the land. But there's also the how in the continuity thesis, ideology and methodology, how they went about killing people. So the German general von Trotta issued an annihilation order, which essentially called for the elimination of the indigenous people. Unlike Hitler, for whom we have no papers in which he actually said, we are going to kill all the Jews in Germany and the other countries we come to control. Here was an actual physical paper, an annihilation order. The Germans, as I mentioned, set up concentration camps. They set up a death camp. And because of their tactics of forced labor, whipping, sexual violence, they forbid interracial unions between Germans and indigenous people, which is a prelude to the Nuremberg Laws. Eugen Fischer, whose name may be familiar to some members of the audience, actually went to the colony where he initiated medical experiments. And the Germans sent skulls back to Germany to be measured as a way of proving the inferiority of the African people. Heinrich Göring was an early governor of the colony, and his son Hermann Göring becomes Hitler's right-hand man during the Holocaust. So there's all kinds of connections to be found between these two historical eras and these two genocides, which are only separated by 30 years.
To ask a quick follow-up, you mentioned the annihilation order, which you do a wonderful job detailing in the book. Do you see that as sort of the moment of transition between this imperial gaze to a more genocidal one? I guess what I'm asking is, there for you, is there one moment, or is it a sort of a slow buildup, and then eventually they reach a tipping point and then they can't come back?
I think that the notion of racial hierarchy is something the Germans brought with them to Africa in the 1880s. And the annihilation order is not issued until October 1904. So it may well be something that functions as a kind of culmination, but I don't think it was new. It was the embodiment of, and of course, this is not only true of the Germans. Other people who colonized Africa in the era of colonization, the British, the French, the Portuguese, also held these ideas of racial hierarchy. And for example, if we look at the trends of colonization in Rwanda, the Germans first and then the Belgians, a racial hierarchy was set up there between the Tutsis and the Hutu. And I think you can draw a direct line from that racial hierarchy to the genocide that occurs in Rwanda in 1994.
Yeah, no, I thank you for that. I think the explanation of these terms would be helpful as to keep in mind as we go along. So let's move sort of to the beginning of the book. I want to ask you who Hendrik Witboy is. Why is he important to your story? And sort of what is his background? What is his history with the Germans? Because it's he's very unique. I know he's on Namibian money, so he's obviously important. I'll let you go.
Sure. So Witboy was a Nama revolutionary. Nama being one of the dominant indigenous groups in Namibia. And he, to give you a little bit of background biographical information on him, he was educated by missionaries. There were missionaries from Protestant and Catholic churches in Namibia before colonization. He learned the Cape Dutch language from the missionaries, and he became a very devout Christian. And he uses his understanding of Christian principles to call the Germans to account for their failure to act like Christians, to act on their religious beliefs. He was the chief of his people, and he struggled with the Germans from their arrival in 1884, and the colony becomes official in 85. And he struggled with the Germans until his death on the battlefield in 1905 at the age of 75 years old. So he is a heroic figure in my view and the view of many Namibian people. And he's very important to my story because he represents what I call the African gaze of resistance. So the Germans were gazing at the Africans with this genocidal gaze, but many Africans were resisting being denigrated by the Germans in their gaze, and believed wholeheartedly in their right to be perceived as full human beings. They were not subhuman. So the most important thing one of the most important things that Heinrich Witboi did as part of this gaze of resistance and to demonstrate to the Germans that he wasn't subhuman, is that he kept an archive of personal papers and letters that he exchanged with other indigenous people, particularly the Herero, and also the letters he exchanged with various German military officials and leaders and so forth. And he kept this archive in a large red notebook. And for me, the very act of keeping this history, of writing and gathering history, puts the lie to the German claim that these African people were subhuman. He's demonstrating that he understands what is the essence of his indigenous group, the Nama, and why it's important to keep records and to create history. And so opening the book with the story of Heinrich Witboi in chapter one was an intentional effort on my part to recover African voices and to honor them and to make it clear how much they resisted and how much they suffered at the hands of the Germans. So the Germans wanted to impose these things called quote-unquote protective treaties. They tried to get different indigenous groups to sign these treaties, which essentially meant that the indigenous people were agreeing not to fight with Germans, and the Germans in turn would protect them, quote-unquote, from other indigenous people, because various kinds of skirmishes over cattle and grazing areas and so forth occurred occasionally between indigenous groups. And Witboi understood that these protective treaties were a sham, that they were a way to divide the indigenous people. And I think it might be useful for me to share with you some quotations from Witboi to give the audience a sense of his prose in this archive, which is available. It's been translated into English. So he used the archive basically for three purposes: to assert his identity, as I mentioned, as a form of resistance, and also to record military strategy. So in 1892, he takes up his notebook to write minutes of an important meeting that he had with a man who was the German governor at the time, a man named Bon Francois. And Francois was always trying to get Witboi to sign one of these so-called protective treaties. And Witboi writes to von Francois very philosophically. He says, "What is protection? What are we being protected against? From what danger or difficulty or suffering can one chief be protected by another?" In other words, he, as chief of the Nama, be protected by the chief of the Germans. He goes on to say, This part of Africa is the realm of us red chiefs. If danger threatens one of us, which he feels he cannot meet on his own, he can call on his brothers among the red chiefs, saying, come on, brothers, let us together oppose this danger, which threatens to invade our Africa, for we are one color and custom, and this Africa is ours. For the fact that we various red chiefs occupy our realms and home grounds is but a lesser division of the one Africa. So this passage has often been cited as an example of his early Pan-African sensibility, his sense of community with other indigenous groups in the region in Southwest Africa, and his recognition that that's where his strength lies, not with these so-called protective treaties of the Germans. So as you mentioned, he is revered as a hero in Namibia now. When I was visiting Namibia last year, I was able to go to a huge memorial, which includes a grave for Hendrik Witbooi. His archive was named a UNESCO Memory of the World object in 2005. And one of the greatest thrills for me when I was in Windhoek, the capital of Namibia last year, was to actually see this red notebook, which had been seized by the Germans during a unprovoked attack they made on Witbooi's camp and brought to Germany, but eventually returned to Namibia. And it's in the archive there. The letter's no longer red, but I actually saw Witbooi's writing and these letters and so forth, which was quite electrifying for me.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a little bit more about these protective treaties. You do talk about them a great deal. He resisted signing these treaties for a very long time. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. Despite this unprovoked attack by the Germans, after which they had destroyed, they'd killed many women and children and captured some of the women and children and destroyed a lot of his camp, his encampment with his people. And so they moved to a mountain range in Namibia, and he undertook a battle with the Germans to try to maintain his independence and his integrity. And eventually, because of the superior firepower the Germans had, he had to surrender. And for the next 10 years, having finally been forced to sign one of these protective treaties, he actually had to serve as a kind of soldiers for the Germans. And he and his men were deployed by the Germans as scouts and as people who were knowledgeable about the geographic territory. Namibia is a very desert-like country, and knowing where the water holes was key to survival. So this is the kind of guidance that he and his men provided for a decade. And after the Herero rose in rebellion against the Germans and then were vanquished at the Battle of Waterberg in 1904, Witbooi could no longer stomach being forced to work on the German side. And he and his people rose against the Germans. They saw that the military strategy that the Herero had used to have a kind of Western-style battle encounter was not successful. And so he conducted a guerrilla war, which lasted for 3 years. But as I mentioned, he was ultimately killed on the battlefield, and his people were forced to surrender.
Was there any pressure from other Africans, other African leaders, chiefs, for him to sign one of these treaties? Was there any of that sort of that kind of counter pressure from his own people to say, okay, enough is enough, we should just give in?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was pressure in that way from within the Nama people when they lost the battle in the Nakloft Mountains that I mentioned. But actually, in the archive, there are letters that he wrote chiding other chiefs for signing these protection treaties. He understood the danger of divide and conquer by the Germans. And he would write, for example, he wrote a letter to the leader of the Herero, who was one of the early people to sign such a treaty, saying, you know, this is really a bad idea. We should be fighting together. So I don't think there was much pressure on him from other chiefs, but from within his own people, once he had lost the battle, he had to surrender.
Okay, so let's switch gears a little bit to the middle parts of the book. And explain to us first let's talk about what colonial literature is, and then we'll talk about the specific pieces of colonial literature that you detail in this book, but it might not be a genre of literature that everyone is familiar with.
Sure. These are novels written either by European people on the ground in a colony, whether it be in South Africa or South America, wherever the colony happens to be located. And they're also written by people back in the metropolitan area, the fatherland in the case of Germany or France or England. And in many ways, these novels typically valorize the colonizing forces, the imperialists. They demonstrate that the colonizers bring religion, they bring education, in some cases medical treatments, quote-unquote civilization, as if the colonized people, the Africans, the Latin Americans, had no civilization of their own, no religious beliefs of their own, no history of their own prior to the arrival of the colonizers. So it's this kind of white liberal missionary zeal kind of notion that is often explored in these colonizing colonial novels. You know, occasionally there's a colonial novel that will be something of a critique. One might think most famously of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which is a controversial novel. Chinua Achebe, a famous African writer, called it a very racist novel, but there are literary critics who have made the other claim, that it's the novel which criticizes the colonial effort of the British in Africa and the colonial effort of the Belgians in the so-called Belgian Congo. But I think more often these novels praise the efforts of the imperialists.
And they were quite popular in Germany, correct?
Very popular. And so the book I write about as an exemplar of a colonial novel is called, in English, Pater Moore's Journey to Southwest Africa. And this is a novel written by a German Lutheran pastor whose name is Gustav Frenzen. And it was published in 1906, so just 2 years after the beginning of this indigenous resistance and revolution against the German colonizers in their colony. He had been writing fiction for a while as a Lutheran minister, but Pater Moore was his first big bestseller, and it was such a bestseller in Germany that it allowed him to resign from his work as a Lutheran pastor and take up writing full time. It's significant that Gustav Frenzen never traveled to Africa, and he relied on conversations with soldiers who had returned from the colony, as well as reading accounts in newspapers and reading memoirs for creating this novel, which is essentially set up as if it is a memoir. It's written in the first person by this character, Peter Moore, or Pater Moore. And he was a member of what the Germans called the Schutztruppe, or the protective forces. He was a German soldier who went out from Hamburg, which is where most of the ships departed from. And the early part of the novel, he recounts all the stereotypes that he has of Africa and Africans. And there's a lot of exoticism in this, and there's also a lot of racial hierarchy in how he's thinking about his encounter with Africa. And he arrives, and then he takes part in the Battle of Waterberg and in the genocide. And though those terms are not used in the novel, genocide being a term that wasn't created until after World War II, it's very clear that this is what Peter Moore is involved in. And he does a lot of complaining about the climate and the Africans and the poor food that he has. But the novel also has passages which clearly justify the genocide. The image of Europeans that's projected in the novel is that they are the rightful conquerors of the Dark Continent. So it's a profoundly racist novel, and Peter Moore and his officers and the military chaplain represent the genocidal gaze in the novel. And again, I think just reading a brief quotation here would be helpful. So as the officer is trying to warm up the troops for the coming battle, he tells them, these blacks have deserved death before God and man, not because they've murdered 200 farmers and have revolted against us, but because they have built no houses and dug no wells. God has let us conquer here because we are the nobler and more advanced people. That is not saying much in comparison with this black nation, but we must see to it that we become better and braver before all nations of the earth. To the nobler and more vigorous belongs the world. That is the justice of God. I mean, you can almost hear phrases from Nazi leaders in that quote that I just read, which was put into the mouth of an officer in the Gustav Frenssen novel. And so it's clear that the novel blatantly approves of genocide. It became a standard text in German classrooms. Kids were assigned to read this book throughout the early 20th century in Germany. And it was avidly read by Hitler youth, who took a great deal of inspiration from it. So much so that Hitler ordered that pocket-sized editions of the book be published again and again in the 1940s, and these were distributed free to the Wehrmacht. And I actually have one of these copies that was carried in a soldier's rucksack. They were meant to be an inspiration to Hitler's soldiers for the glory of the German military. So I believe that it was crucial to critique this novel in my book and to make it plain how Peter Moore, the main character, himself embodies the genocidal gaze. So in each chapter of the book, I try to demonstrate how the literary text that I'm analyzing embodies the genocidal gaze, embraces or critiques, and we're coming to some chapters now with critiques, this genocidal gaze, the notion of racial hierarchy.
Before we move to the critiques, I just want to ask one follow-up. I mean, obviously this novel is one of the most famous, as you mentioned, widely used in classrooms, used, you know, admired by Hitler and so forth. But was most colonial literature, German colonial literature, sort of in this mold, same kind of sort of narrative arc as Peter Moore's, or is there something fundamentally different that makes this one stand out?
I would say the majority of the German colonial novels have this racial hierarchy as a kind of assumption about the relationship between the colonized and the colonizers. Germany came late to colonization, but once they did, they had colonies in other places in Africa. For example, the country we now call Cameroon. They had a colony in China, and they had colonies in various Pacific islands. So it wasn't just German Southwest Africa as their colony, but several of these other colonies. And as I mentioned, they lost this colony, the one in Southwest Africa, early in World War I when the British invaded the colony and took control. And then the Brits kept control of the country we now call Namibia until 1990. Namibia was one of the last countries in Africa to gain its independence, the independence movement beginning on the continent in the 1950s. And actually, under South African apartheid, and a system of apartheid was imposed in Namibia as well. And the traces of this are still very visible in the country. But I would say the majority of colonial novels are similar to Frentzen's.
Yeah, I was just curious as to what made this one stand out for the general German reader. For Hitler, was it the writing? Was it the availability, affordability?
I think it may in part have been the fact that it really focused on the German military, and so it became a way of glorifying the fatherland. Some of the other colonial novels, for example, those written by women, deal more with issues of families, the settler colony, men's and women's roles as farmers or shopkeepers or whatever in the colony. But this book really deals with the military and glorifying Germany. And I'm guessing that that's what accounted for its popularity, particularly during the Third Reich.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. So you mentioned in your previous answer about critiques. And I think this is probably a good time to switch to that side. And I'm talking mostly about Tim's, both the novel and the memoir being In My Brother's Shadow. Again, I guess similar to our discussion of the last book, is there a formula to critiques, or is there, how do they function and how are they written?
Tim's two books, which I'm going to talk about briefly, are very different books. One is a novel, and one is a memoir, but both of them are critiques of German violence, of two different German genocides, the one we've been talking about and the Nazi Holocaust. And so I wouldn't say there's exactly a formula, but the similarities among these various books would be in the critique. Some members of the listening audience may be familiar with the German term Vergangenheitsbewältigung. This is a term that was created in the post-World War II, post-Holocaust era. It puts together some German words to mean coming to terms with the past. And this is a process that the German society has been involved with since the end of World War II, essentially coming to terms with the Holocaust. Why did Germany commit the Holocaust? There has not been a similar coming to terms with this earlier genocide. In fact, something that some literary critics call colonial amnesia has surrounded the German genocide in Africa. And this is one reason why I believe that it's so important to talk about this earlier genocide and to talk about the literary texts, and we'll come to William Kentridge's art installation. But how has artists come to terms with these genocides. And Germany is only just beginning to do this as far as the earlier genocide is concerned. There's been this Vergangenheitsbewältigung for the Second World War and for the genocide of 11 million people in the Holocaust, but not for the earlier genocide. And so I think the part of my book that talks about the critiques is really essential.
Yeah, and so can you give us a flavor of what the critiques are? I mean, they may seem obvious, you know, and then explain also a little bit of background of Tim as well.
So Franzen's novel comes out in 1906, the one we were just talking about Peter Moore. And as I said, it embodied the German genocidal gaze. Germany lost its colonies, as I've mentioned, with the Treaty of Versailles, all of the colonies in China and the South Pacific and so forth. And then the colonial archives, all the exchange between the government in the fatherland and the governors in these various colonies was sealed. No one could get access to these archives. And they remained sealed through the Nazi era in the Third Reich. And then many of the records were captured by the Soviets at the end of World War II and taken back to the USSR. And so aside from these self-congratulatory memoirs that were published in the early 20th century after Germany lost its colonies, these memoirs by German military people who'd been in the various colonies, the colonial era was somewhat forgotten, colonial amnesia. There was no acknowledgement that a genocide had been committed there. In the 1960s, the archives were returned from Russia to the communist part of Germany. You know, Germany was divided after World War II, and the German Democratic Republic was controlled by Russia and adopted the communist ideology. And so a young historian by the name of Horst Drexler was just getting ready to write his dissertation when these archives arrived back I think they were put in Potsdam in Berlin. And he was one of the first people to open up these records. It must have been a very exciting moment. And to really begin to get some of the dirty little secrets of the colonial era of Germany and very clear writing about what happened in the genocide. And he had grown up in the German Democratic Republic, educated in communist ideology. And unlike the people in West Germany who felt a need to hide this earlier past or to glorify it, he felt no such need. He had been trained to think about Lenin's quotation that imperialism is the highest stage of capitalism. And so he felt very free to write a history, which he did as a dissertation that was subsequently published called Let Us Die Fighting in English, the English translation. And it came out in 1966. And it was literally the first book to really criticize what Germany had done in German Southwest Africa. So 12 years later, in 1978, a young German writer named Uwe Timm, T-I-M-M, published a novel called Marenga. Two things about this novel. First of all, Marenga was another indigenous hero like Heinrich Wittboy, who had fought against the Germans during the guerrilla warfare period. And it's very clear that Uwe Timm had read Horst Drexler's book, because there are passages in the novel that come right out of descriptions in Let Us Die Fighting of the conflict. So Kim, to give you a little bit of background about him, was the son of a German soldier during World War II. His father was conscripted into the Wehrmacht, and he was the brother, his much older brother, of a man who had enlisted in the army and become a member of the infamous German SS. And he is too young to fight during World War II. And when his father comes home from the war, his brother, by the way, did not survive. He died of wounds at his at the front. And his father comes home and doesn't talk much, which was very common, about World War II. It had ended badly for the Germans in many ways. And so Tim is looking back at the German genocide in 1904 through the lens of World War II and the Holocaust, what happened in the second German genocide. And so you might say that when Tim sat down to write his novel, Marenga, which is also very much a military novel, a novel about soldiers in the country we now call Namibia, he was, to use a literary term, writing back to Gustav Frenssen. He saw his book, Marenga, as a critique and a corrective of the novel Peter Moore by Gustav Frenssen. And I think that the dramatic approach that he takes in the book is because he's looking through this kind of double lens of the genocidal gaze of German genocides. So unlike Peter Moore, Gustav Frenssen's soldier, who embraces racial hierarchies and the genocidal gaze, Tim gives us a soldier who's engaged in the same historical struggle, but has a very different reaction. He gradually becomes disillusioned and then appalled by the behavior and the attitudes of his fellow Schutztruppe, his fellow German soldiers. And Tim uses this disillusionment and ultimately sort of terror on the part of this soldier to critique both that genocide and by implication, the Holocaust. 25 years later, after his father has died, he didn't want to write this memoir while his father was still alive. He writes the book In My Brother's Shadow, which was a bestseller in Germany. And Uwe Timm, I should say, has written some humorous books. He's got one called The Invention of Curry Sausage. He's written books about capitalism in Germany. And he's written some children's books. He's still very much alive, and he's a well-regarded writer in Germany. In My Brother's Shadow, this memoir is a much more direct and devastating expose of German nationalism, of militarism, of genocidal violence, because he sees that having happened in both cases. And he recounts in the memoir some of the just the ways in which he as a child was the subject of this kind of random German violence that he's critiquing. And so he really interrogates German values, and he asks very difficult questions about the Holocaust. And the memoir is part of a category of post-World War II writing, which is called Vaterliteratur. That is to say, in English, father literature. So these were books written by the next generation, the children of the Nazis, the children of the men who fought in the war, whether they agreed with Hitler or not. They were often drafted and forced to fight. This Vaterliteratur can be summed up as books which resulted from these young children, when they reach teenage years, asking the question, what did you do in the war, Daddy? What, you know, were you a guard at a camp? Were you a member of the Nazi party? Were you one of the Germans who ratted out gay men and women who identified Jews living in their apartment building? What did you do in the war? Did you run the trains to the camps? Were you part of the Einsatzgruppen? And this resulted in a whole genre of literature, which is a genre of critique, which is, you know, both of these books that I've mentioned by Tim are part of this genre.
You mentioned earlier about how artists deal with these issues, and you mentioned the black box. I think now is a time we'll shift gears a little bit and talk about the black box. Just give a brief description of what it is. Why it's important, because I'll be honest, this is something before reading your book I'd never heard of, and I thought it was fascinating.
Well, as I mentioned, I was thinking about this topic for a few years before, and while I was writing another book on the Golem, so I had some time to just collect material. And I go to Germany quite frequently as part of my research, and happened to go to an exhibit at the Martin Gropius Bau in 2012. It was an exhibit about the connection between art and journalism, and happened upon this art installation in one of the galleries by an artist who was new to me, William Kentridge. And what this looked like when I encountered it in the gallery was a miniature theater, maybe about the size of a card table, and it's animated and it's deep. So there are various layers to what is shown on the stage. It moves. It almost functions as a kind of palimpsest, uncovering more and more material as it goes. And the display incorporates what you see in these various layers is early 20th century German colonial film clips, most notably one of a German man killing a rhinoceros, cutting off his leg as a trophy. Mechanized figures, little sort of puppets on springs and sticks. There's music going on in the background, photographs, pop-up photographs of the colonial era in Namibia, maps pop-up, and collages of old newspaper clippings. The whole performance takes 22 minutes, and it can be found on the internet. If people would Google Black Box or Chambre Noir, it goes by both names, and William Kentridge is the name of the artist, and you can see a couple of different YouTube videos that have been made probably surreptitiously in the museum, but you can piece it together and see the whole thing. And it gradually dawned on me as I'm watching this that the subject matter was the German genocide of the Herero in Nama in 1904. And so I just sat there mesmerized watching the 22-minute performance over and over again. And what Kentridge is doing in this black box performance is gesturing in several directions. He's interrogating German guilt for the genocide. He's pointing out the silence about this genocide, the fact that it's been largely hidden. And as I was writing this book, people would say, well, what are you writing about? And I'd tell them, and invariably they would say, I never heard about this genocide in 1904. Everyone's heard of the Holocaust, but not this genocide. And the performance also references Freud's notion of Trauerarbeit, working through grief, the importance of that process of working through grief, and that has not been allowed in the case of this genocide because of colonial amnesia. Kentridge is also drawing links between this earlier genocide, the Holocaust, and apartheid, a system that was very much in place when he was a young boy in South Africa. Kentridge is Jewish. He grew up in South Africa under the apartheid regime. He's white. so it didn't affect him directly, only the people of color and the black South Africans. But both of his parents were anti-apartheid attorneys, so he was intimately aware of the injustice of the apartheid system as he was growing up. He actually traveled to Namibia to research the genocide of the Herero and Nama, and he went into antique shops where he found Nazi memorabilia, because the Germans have remained very much a presence in Namibia up to today, and Hitler hoped to recapture the African colonies and the other colonies that Germany had had in what he envisioned as the thousand-year Reich. And Kentridge also went to the site of the Battle of Waterfield, which is in the Battle of Waterberg in the northern part of the country. And so he used all of that experience, plus his own personal experience and his knowledge of the Holocaust, because many the Jewish population in South Africa is largely from Lithuania, and they migrated to South Africa to avoid the Holocaust. They migrated there in the 30s and 40s. So the performance occurs as the figures move around this small stage, bringing up various kinds of images. And the term black box, the title of this installation, invokes the idea of early cameras, which were sometimes called black boxes, but also the idea of the black box as a recording device in airplanes that, you know, is what the rescuers always look for after a plane crash, because it will have the final recordings of before the disaster. And it's very much functions as a photographic darkroom, as a kind of theater, and as an instrument of surveillance. So yet again, we come upon a piece of art that embodies and critiques the genocidal gaze. The genocidal gaze in these three instances, the early genocide, the Holocaust, and apartheid. And one thing that is perhaps not known by members of the listening audience is that many of the people who created the apartheid system in South Africa went to Germany to study during the Third Reich. Apartheid comes into being in 1948, just 3 years after World War II ends, and many of its features echo aspects of the Third Reich. So here we have the genocidal gaze again, this idea that certain people are expendable. They are subhuman. This would include the indigenous people that I've been talking about, the 6 million Jews, and the huge number of massacres of indigenous people that occurred under the apartheid administration.
Yeah, I found this chapter so fascinating, because the idea that the three events, there could be a line drawn between the three things, not only helps to really demonstrate your point when you read the whole book from beginning to end, but also demonstrates that, you know, this is a widespread problem, not something just confined to Germans, but it takes place in other places in Africa, and not just in Africa, but other places that have experienced colonization. So I have looked up the videos of the performance, and I would encourage listeners to actually go and piece the videos together and see for yourself, because it is a fascinating exhibit. And like I said, when I asked the question, I had never heard of this before I had read your book.
Let me just finish by saying it does link events in the 20th century that were quote unquote justified by racial hierarchy. And I think it serves in a really compelling way as a memorial for the people who have been murdered, and also as a kind of warning to museum goers that they have a responsibility to remember and to speak out and to resist oppression.
I think this is a very critical chapter in your book, and does leave people with a lot, you know, to think about as they go to the museums and they go to, you know, they visit Berlin and they visit some of the historical sites, the commemoration sites, that they're not, you know, they're for to generate your thinking, not just to go look at.
Right.
Yeah.
Yesterday's New York Times ran a fascinating full page article. This would be the July 14th, 2019 issue of the Sunday New York Times, which talked about the use, increasing use of surveillance and facial recognition in our society and in other countries. It's very prominent in China right now, for example, and how this traces back to these early eugenicists who believed that by looking at a criminal's face, you could tell that they had a criminal background or a criminal temperament or personality. And these early efforts by eugenicists were based on racial hierarchy, and now we have the same thing going on in our society in a really, really scary way. So, yeah, I think it's very, very pertinent.
So let's move to the last chapter of your book that deals with African novelists and how they perceive Germany. I'm wondering if you can explain how they do perceive it in sort of our contemporary our contemporary time, and what are some of the things you look at?
So the last chapter focuses on a Ghanaian novelist whose name is Ama Atta Aidu, and her novel that I'm working on here is called Our Sister Killjoy. And this novel was published in 1977. So I open the book with an African voice, and I close the book. The last two chapters are African voices. And the subtitle of Ama Atta Aidu's book is Reflections from a Black-Eyed Squint. So here we have the actual phrase referring to the African gaze, the black-eyed squint, the gaze of Africans upon Western imperialists. And this is Ama Atta Aidu's best-known novel. And basically, it recounts the study abroad journey of her young female character, whose name is Sissy. And Sissy's given a scholarship to leave Africa and travel to Frankfurt, Germany, as a study abroad student. And there she encounters racism for the first time. She's in the railroad station, and somebody yells out in German, "Oh, look, there's a black person." And because she comes from Africa, she's never really had anyone point her out as a black person. This is what her whole country looks like. She's Ghanaian, as is Aidu, the author. And reacts to this by realizing that this German person is pointing out difference, and in some senses is pointing out that she's less human or less valuable than the person who's sort of mocking her. She encounters also, in addition to this racism, she encounters traces of the Holocaust. Part of her task as a study abroad student is to plant trees in a forest. And this is a forest where murders had happened during the Holocaust, and she comes upon evidence of this. And what I focus on in the chapter is, in the same way that Uwe Timm was writing back to Gustav Frentzen, I think Ama Atta Aidu here is writing back to Joseph Conrad. She's writing back to The Heart of Darkness. That's a novel in which someone comes from England to the Belgian Congo. In this case, someone is leaving Ghana and going to Germany. So the journey is reversed. And essentially, I think what she is inviting the reader to do is to perceive Germany as the heart of darkness in the 20th century, rather than Africa, which has always been referred to by imperialists as the dark continent. So the novel contains many references to Hitler, to the so-called, quote, House of Aryan, to the Holocaust, to eugenics, to other genocides. So it's made very clear what she's doing here. She also uses intertext. This is a process called intertextuality in literary theory, drawing connections between books, showing how one writer has used or is critiquing an earlier book. She uses intertexts from fairy tales, and we always associate fairy tales with Germany and the Grimm brothers. She uses intertexts from Charlotte Bronte's novel, Jane Eyre. And so I think what she's inviting the reader to do is to see, once again, that this is a critique of the genocidal gaze, that it's an example of the African gaze, which is resisting the racial hierarchy implicit in the German gaze on indigenous people.
Yeah. As a way to wrap up discussion of your book, I wonder if you could tell the listeners just one or two main things you would like people to take away from your book, both by, you know, after they actually read the book and sort of listening to you talk today. Yeah, give us that.
Okay. So I think the first thing that I very much wanted readers to take away from the genocidal gaze is the danger of racial hierarchies, because these still exist in our world. And as I try to make evident in the book, they can lead to genocide. They can lead to dangerous exploitation of people who have been deemed at the bottom of the racial hierarchy, which is where the Germans, for example, placed the Jews during the Holocaust. And by racial hierarchy, I mean setting a group apart as an enemy, as subhuman. For example, during the Rwandan genocide, the Hutu called the Tutsis cockroaches. The Nazis called the Jews vermin. And looking at a particular group of people as lacking in civilization, as bestial, as barbarians. And I think this can lead very quickly to agreement that a group can be exterminated, can be eliminated in order to gain land or for other purposes, because they're life unworthy of life, a phrase from Nazi ideology. So again, we can draw a line from the Herero and Nama to the Nazis to the Rwandan genocide, these connections between imperialism and genocide. So America is an imperial power in the world. Have we engaged in a genocide? We don't often talk about the genocide of Native Americans that allowed us to take control of our country. We don't often think about slavery as one of the forces that enabled us to become a powerful, economically viable nation. So these are twin acts of oppression at the basis of American history. And so I hope that the danger of racial hierarchies is one takeaway from the book. And similarly, the danger of colonial amnesia. Germany denied and repressed this genocide from 1904 for over 100 years. Only in 2017 did Germany finally mount an exhibit at their historical museum in Berlin, which formally acknowledged the genocide. It was a very powerful exhibit that I had the opportunity to see, which had a lot of artifacts from the colonial era, including this annihilation order that I mentioned. It was actually there in the exhibit. The German parliament, the the main legislative body in Germany has yet to acknowledge that this was a genocide. They have yet to apologize, except a minister went to Namibia and apologized, but it wasn't a formal agreed upon apology from the whole German government. And they have refused to pay any kind of reparations to the remaining Herero and Nama people, the descendants of the victims. And so this is a second takeaway that I would hope people would have from the book, that the colonial genocide, in a real sense, made the Holocaust imaginable. The fact that Germany had done this once and gotten away with it, repressed it, in many ways enabled them in ideology and methodology to carry out the Holocaust. And I think maybe it will raise a question in the mind of readers, if history had been changed, if Germany had acknowledged this genocide early on, would that have changed the course of history? Or now that it's being acknowledged, how will it change the course of history?
Yeah, I think that this is a good way to wrap up your book, because I think it is important for those listening that this book is very timely and very important. And I would encourage all our listeners to go and get it, read it. It's actually not too long, so you'll get through it. It's definitely and it's also a very, very interesting book. A lot of interesting things that you probably haven't read about or thought about come up in it, and I can't highly recommend it enough. Before I let you go, though, oh, you're welcome. Before I let you go, I always like to ask the authors, now that they're done with this project and it's on the shelves and people are buying it and reading it, what are you working on now?
So I'm focusing in on one aspect of this 1904 genocide, and that is the topic of sexual violence. It was a long time before Holocaust studies scholars acknowledged that German troops routinely raped women, even Jewish women. There was always sort of a piety in Holocaust studies that, because of the Nuremberg laws that forbid sexual contact between, quote, Aryans, unquote, and people who were Jewish, that no Jewish women were raped. And we now know, after there's been admittance in the field of Holocaust studies to feminist approaches to the Holocaust, that rape was widespread. It's a common occurrence in wars all over the world and through history. And so virtually nothing has been written about sexual violence that occurred between the Schutztruppe in their colony in Africa and the indigenous women who were there. But we know from primary source documents that there were brothels set up with indigenous women. There was widespread rape of indigenous women who were often in unprotected situations, or if they were in concentration camps. We know there were actually buildings set up on the perimeter of these camps where women from who were prisoners in the camp, in the concentration camps, were forced to serve as the German men in these buildings. And so that's the focus of my work now. And I have an article forthcoming on that in a new book that will be out next year called The Palgrave Handbook of Holocaust Literature and Culture, which is edited by Phyllis Lassner. And it will be published by Palgrave. There's only one other article by an American scholar on this topic available, and a sprinkling of articles in German, but I think it's a really important topic.
Yeah, no, it sounds fascinating, and if there ever is a book that you do on it, I would love to have you back to talk about it. So that sort of wraps up our show for today. I want to thank Dr. Elizabeth Baer again for agreeing to come and speak with us. Again, the book is The Genocidal Gaze, From German Southwest Africa to the Third Reich. And I want to thank all our listeners for listening, and we will see you next time.